You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our bias is explicit. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and if you've been around the show for a while, you know that I am a New England Patriots fan. And if you're a football fan, I'm sure anyone knows at this point, the Patriots are not doing well this season. You also know that we record these episodes on Sunday. So let me just say, I'm not a fan of Cam Newton. I think he makes too many mistakes. So I'm kind of dealing with that right now. I took a little bit of time before we record, about 15 minutes after the game ended. I think I'm okay. But if I have Tourette's about Cam Newton and the Patriots, that's why. Now you know. No, we should be okay. Especially with the new direction the show is going here, right? And a lot of you expressed support for that new direction in Discord and in personal messages. So let's see how this goes. Let's see. Maybe we can grow the audience now. Maybe other people are as sick of politics as we are. And I think a lot of this week is going to be calibration. It's going to be, hey, you know, where exactly is that line between politics and philosophy, between discussing ideas and discussing politics? I think we'll figure out a lot of that. And we'll do it with the help of my co-host joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. I'm glad it took you 15 minutes. It's about 24 hours later. I'm still not over Michigan losing to Michigan State. We were discussing in the pre-show, man, we gotta fire a defensive coordinator. No adjustments being made. Every single ball thrown by Michigan State was underthrown. Defensive backs never turning their head, looking over their shoulder. Like every single one of those were interceptions. And it was just, you know, very frustrating to see. Woodson was practically jumping out of the TV, talking about how the defensive backs need to turn and look over their shoulder. Because of how underthrown each one of the long balls were. So, it's hard. I don't blame the kids at all, right? The DBs. I mean, this is only their second game of the season, right? But man, you got to make that game time adjustment.
Yeah, and I think we're in different places because of what you just said. That you're only into your second game of the season. I mean, the Patriots are what, 2-5 now? They've lost 4 in a row. And in the middle of the game, when they were coming back and they made it close, right? They only lost by a field goal to the Bills. Which, what does it say about how good the Bills are? They're pretty bad then. I was actually like, how are we actually in this game? How might we possibly win this game? And then at the end, when it looked like we were driving to win the game, I was like, we can't possibly win this game. So when it happened, I was like, oh, okay, this makes sense. Like in the moment, in the exact moment it happened, I was like, ah, come on, Newton. And I was upset. But then like 30 seconds later, I was like, oh, okay, well, of course. Whereas with you, second game of the season, there's high hopes for your team, and you're playing your in-state rival, and you're making basic mistakes. I think that's a lot harder to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, the kids' mistakes I can get. This has been quite a roller coaster of a training season and start of season, right? But you know, the coaching mistakes, it's just like what are we even doing? You know, that's such an easy adjustment to make. I mean, it's almost unforgivable. It's unforgivable enough not to make it right away because it was pretty obvious by like halfway through the first quarter, but no halftime adjustment either. I mean, Jesus, it's so obvious.
I know. And I think a lot of people are kind of phoning things in this year because of the whole pandemic and everything and making easy mistakes because of it. So I think that's another example of it. So
that's true, but not us.
I don't think we are. I think we've had a pretty good season considering. I don't know what the midsiders out there think, but I think we've had a pretty good season. I think we're adapting, and I think we're adapting in a way that is going to make the show even better and give us a unique place in the market going forward. So yeah. Why don't we go forward in this episode? Does that sound good, William?
Sounds good to me.
Hit the music. Not for the news. Not for the news. Hit the music for Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. There's not really fun. Cause I'm on a roll here. I hope that you're making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and come on. You know what would make us smile but not shut up? Is if you supported us on Patreon and or Locals. No one supports us on both. That'd be crazy if they did. Don't do both. Do or, right? Patreon, you can do per episode. Locals, you can do per month. They're both subscription-based in that way. All you have to do is go to themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. We appreciate any and all support. As you just heard, different music, different first segment. I didn't think we were going to go into this change that quickly. But you know what? After last episode, the feedback we got, and reflecting on it some more, it just makes sense to me. And I've felt an immense amount of relief. I felt an immense amount of relief in my life. And it even gave me an opportunity to sort of, you know, think back and reflect on how this has sort of been brewing for a very, very, very long time. So last night I just took some time, you know, because I'm recording this on the Sunday after the time change. So we had the extra hour. It was Halloween. I didn't, you know, have a costume. I wasn't going out trick-or-treating or anything. Went to the gym earlier in the night. And then I just sort of was relaxing, listening to music, just going through, partially trying to find songs for the wedding playlist to play during the reception. And also just, you know, listening to stuff I hadn't listened to in a long time. And one of those bands I hadn't listened to in a long time was this pop punk band that I'd seen at Warped Tour way back in the day called You, Me, and Everyone We Know. And it really made me remember why I hadn't listened to them. I hadn't listened to them because on Twitter, the lead singer had literally told me not to listen to them. And why had he told me that? Well, this was around the time that Frack Nation came out. Frack Nation was the documentary that Daniel worked on. I helped with it a little bit. In order to help them, they needed to pay someone to transcribe all of Gasland by Josh Fox. So I did that. So I was very familiar with the content and, you know, the arguments and everything and the stories about all of this. And the lead singer of You, Me, and Everyone We Know tweeted out some misinformation. So I tweeted a link to him correcting him. You know, I didn't say, you know, here's correcting you. I just tweeted it to him like, as an alternative, like, hey, here's some other information. And he immediately replied about how ignorant I was and told me to stop listening to his band. So this is literally the first time in like 8 years, 7 years, whenever Frack Nation came out, that I listened to his band. And, you know, there was still some of the good stuff I remember, but honestly, I've changed since then. So it's probably a good thing he told me not to listen to it anymore. But that just shows me that all of this has been brewing for a very long time. So I think it's a good choice. I think going forward with this show, not being as politically focused, being as focused on our lives, I think that's much, much better. And I want to get, William, I want to get your feedback on that last episode. And I want you to share with the listeners sort of, and with me, what do you think about this whole concept, this whole approach? What spurred it? Are you on the same page? All those kind of thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think, you know, I've been tackling the sort of problem space that we're dealing with, you know, we've talked about it the last couple seasons about interpersonal hostility and thinking about those boundaries and what really the issue is with the way people are treating each other. And I think focusing more on those values, those spiritual values, and moving up the philosophy chain is going to be incredibly helpful, because the kind of poison that social justice is put into the culture is making it really hard, right? It by the constant changing of goalposts, it messes up people's epistemology and even down to the words, right, we use. And the, you know, I think that it seems right now, at least, it's easier for us to hold on to the morality, right? That's something that we've always sort of pushed against the cultural trend, you and I specifically, and most of our audience as well. But this new sort of epistemological push is a different kind of challenge. And so I think fueling up spiritually, right, by talking about the art and how it connects to us and other things in our lives, other values in our lives, and how that's helping out and how we're integrating all those things into our lives. I think that's going to be better for everyone as sort of like fueling up the tanks. But then also I think it ultimately rolls down into other things, right? You'll be able to you know, witness the farce when you see it out in public, when all these political things come up, because you'll have, you'll have a better foundation.
Right. I think the what you said about witnessing the farce when you see it in public, I think it's important now what you're saying about the moral and the epistemological, right? When you're talking about ethics, when you're talking about knowledge, where you're talking about why we know the things we know, the language we use to describe the things we know. I think witnessing the farce becomes even more important to look at it on the level when you're out in public, because the farce isn't always political. And I think that's what we can focus on a lot more now. I mean, there is a lot of political farce, without a doubt, but the political farce is, it's just the same farce over and over again. And as we said, it's a result. And I actually had a chance to listen to Bill Burr this week, his podcast, and he said something that, I mean, again, a lot of the things he said sounds like I could have said it, but he said something about the election that really, to me, points out exactly, I think it sums up neatly why I'm sort of over all of this. So if you want to play that, William.
You know, like I said, I'm done. I'm done giving a fuck and getting all fucking emotional about this shit. All right. If half the country wants a scarecrow with a facelift, he'll be the president. If the other half likes a fucking race baiting fucking, I don't know what the hell he is, then I guess we'll have that guy. But you know what? There's nothing I could do about it.
And that's exactly it, William. That's exactly how I feel. I mean, again, his descriptions of them are perfect, right? And the idea that there's nothing we can do about this micro instance. Right. It's all the macro right now, right? Yeah. It's all witnessing the farce on a day-to-day basis and seeing how that will result in the next 20 years, the next 50 years. That's the problem to fix, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It gets back to exactly the point I was making, right? Like, we've got to move up the philosophical chain here. The attack on, you know, this insular attack on knowledge itself is the real farce to witness. And but the fuel it takes to do that is deeper, right? And so finding those great things and those values and how we're going to integrate them in this sort of, you know, this change has happened slowly over time, right? But it's hit such a fever pitch now that it is time to make tactical adjustments in service of the real strategy, which is living a flourishing life.
Right. And it's not just finding the good things. It's having the interesting discussions that are the non-political discussions. Yeah. And Daniel sent us a great one this week. He sent us a great one, but it's a perfect example of both a great topic to discuss and also how everyone else is so bogged down in the political. So I think it's a great transition topic for us here on the show. And the headline here, it's a Daily Beast article, so maybe it shouldn't be too surprising that it's bogged down in the political. But the headline here is, the new documentary, Assholes a Theory, examines the assholing of America. I mean, that's actually grammatically incorrect. They want to say how America became assholes, not the assholing of America. Assholing of America sounds like America like had an asshole drilled into it. Just a bad gerund use there, Daily Beast. A nation ruled by the biggest asshole of them all, Donald J. Trump. So here's the crazy thing, right? This is an actual quote from the article. This is an actual quote from the article. Without once bringing him up, the director makes clear that Trump is the embodiment of this problem, given that his election to the highest office and subsequent flouting of rules and standards of common decency has made it appear acceptable and, in fact, rewarding to act in the worst possible manner as a means of achieving one's selfish ends. He is, the film silently contends, the apex of American assholery. What? Without bringing him up and silently contending, there seems to be a lot of projection going on here about what an asshole is. And this seems to be a lot of the problem, William. Before we even dive into the argument here, right? Because I think this is based on a book by a professor named Aaron James. And I think that there's some interesting argument here and there's an interesting discussion to be had. But how can you, and I think this is the epistemological thing you're talking about, William. How can you even have these discussions when people project and sidestep and basically, to me, evade by making it about this tribalistic nonsense of the other side? Like, rooting this issue in Trump when the film doesn't bring up Trump seems to miss the point, because this shit that they're describing, and we'll get into the details of it in like 2 seconds here. This is describing. This happens everywhere with everyone.
Yeah, yeah. We know that this is a human bias, right? Where all bad characteristics are attributed to the outsider, right? And we've talked about it before, because we're sort of obliterating the individual and everyone has to be identified by their group, right? Their group identity. Then of course that evil other has those negative traits, but you doing those same behaviors are for a noble end, right? So if we treat a racist, quote unquote, as an asshole, then that's, you know, that's not achieving your selfish end. So it's totally cool, right? Because that's altruistic. You're standing up for the oppressed. And so the rationalization, it's two things. It's the projection and then the rationalization, right? And this is a bias that everyone has, right? You and I can be guilty of this. It's an automatic sort of thing. It's a thing that's built into the evolution of our human psychology, right? Something we have to be aware of.
Yeah, but I think that's part of what makes you the asshole. I think you're 100% correct, but I think about not you in particular, the asshole, but makes a person an asshole is when you're projecting, are you projecting a benevolent mindset onto someone else or a malevolent mindset? And it seems to me someone like the author of this article who makes it about, oh, wow, we need to go out and vote, is projecting that malevolent mindset onto other people, which shows he's rationalizing his own point of view. Where I sometimes feel like I'm slipping into that naivete that we say kids have sometime, or like, you know, it tends to be attributed to women or girls sometimes, where they just sort of believe everyone is nice, yeah, because they're sort of nice and kind. And I think I sort of make that mistake, which would be my biggest defense about me not being an asshole, is like I assume other people can make rational decisions for themselves. And I probably do that a little too much. And I think that's what you're talking about, is I think as a base way of survival, we have to. And I think that's sort of a root way of almost distinguishing if someone's an asshole or not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I have to, there are evil people, right? But most people are mistaken, right? Including me, I'm probably mistaken on tons of things, right? Most of them, hopefully, irrelevant to my life, right? And that's okay, right? Because I'm not an omniscient God, and objectively, I don't need to be 100% perfect on all knowledge in order to lead a happy and flourishing life, right? Like, I can only do the extent of the things that matter to me and that I have the time to actually pursue and the ability to pursue. So I have to assume that everyone else is in the same boat, right? And that some people have not chosen to think about some of these things seriously, right? Now, I can certainly hold people who have power to a much higher account, right? But to just sort of like assume everyone's an asshole is probably not a good sign just because they disagree with me.
Right, right. So let's go into this definition of asshole a little bit. So as I said, I believe I said the professor's name before, but I'm going to say it again. He's a professor at UC Irvine. He has a PhD from Harvard. His name is Aaron James. He says, the asshole, as I define it, is the guy who allows himself special advantages in cooperative life out of an entrenched sense of entitlement that immunizes him against the complaints of other people. Now, William, I want to translate this a little bit, because I don't think this is a bad definition, but this is something I hate about modern philosophers and why I don't really engage with it, and I don't engage in these type of conversations, because it seems to me this guy, James, Professor James, is using concepts that already exist and creating new terms for them. So when he's talking about cooperative life and giving himself special advantages, an entrenched sense of entitlement, it seems to me he's talking about the social contract and he's talking about narcissism. Mm. It seems like he's saying that people think the social contract doesn't apply to them because of their narcissistic outlook. Am I translating that incorrectly?
I think that makes sense. I would have, you know, without reading the book, I don't want to I'm going to be super provisional, but yeah, it, just looking at this definition, I don't see how it's different than just narcissistic behavior, right? And now a psychologist is supposed to go in and talk about the inner causes of those things, right? So maybe he's distinguishing in it in that way, right? So in other words, he's defining it this way, but then like discussing it more as a, you know, because narcissism is more of a psychological behavioral thing. And this, he might be doing something deeper here, right? In the book, I don't know. But outside of that speculation, like I could just change this to the narcissist, as I define it, is the guy who allows himself special advantages in cooperative life out of an entrenched sense of entitlement that immunizes him against the complaints of other people. And that's exactly what a narcissist does.
Right. But I wanted to key into, exactly right, I wanted to key into, though, the idea of the social contract, because I think that's a big deal about what's going on here, right? And this is where the line gets fuzzy about talking about politics and philosophy, right? Because the social contract is the idea that we make a contract to give up a little bit of our freedom in order to have a government that's by the people and for the people. The idea that, you know, government is to protect us and to resolve disputes, right? I'm not getting into politics as far as how to do that. I'm talking about, you know, what the philosophical reason for government existing is. And here, he's saying that the narcissist doesn't follow that social contract anymore. So even though in the macro we all are under that social contract, they cut corners in the micro. And I, look, maybe it's because I lived in Irvine where this guy is a professor, but I see it here too. I think this exists, right? Let me give you an example I saw earlier today. Maybe you could tell me this, William. Why in front of department stores, in front of big box stores, especially like Walmart, why has that cross, that giant cross section, which is for people to walk, why has that become the area where people get dropped off? Why is it you can just stop your car there, not even putting on your flashers, just so you can let someone out? Why has that become that spot? You hold up all the traffic. That's an example of the assholery this guy is talking about, is it not?
Maybe. I guess maybe. I'm trying to think of other concretes that would fit this that you can see in everyday life. I mean, because some of them, you know, I wouldn't say the person who randomly cuts in front of you in line, right? Because that may be the more pure just narcissist, right? But because there's no like sort of sense of entitlement necessarily really demonstrated in that. But I think the entitlement is kind of the reason I'm hooked on this entitlement is because there seems to be a implied intent there, right? Like, and I don't know if people even like are, I have to imagine that people who just do that are just oblivious, right? Like it would make me uncomfortable to be inconveniencing a bunch of people like that, right?
Well, I think that's the point. I think you've nailed it 100%. Is why we become narcissistic, why we've become assholes in this way. Is
William, my degree from FU says you are 100% correct.
That's two times so far.
Well, you're making good points, and maybe this proves us an even better direction for the show. It's because what's the narrative of what American life is, right? We're not taught anymore about the social contract, right? He talks about cooperative life. Do you see how even framing it that way changes the way you think of it? Cooperative life. Well, if it's cooperative life, I'm just going to get away with what other people are going to let me get away with. I'm not saying I personally would do that, but it's like people who do a project together, right? People who do a project together, there's always the one person who does all the work because ultimately they know that person's going to do the work and it's still going to get done. But it doesn't work that way in a society unless everyone pulls their own weight. To the best of their ability, the society will eventually collapse. That's the social contract. But it's not about that anymore. The social contract is taken as a given. Simply by being born, the social contract, you don't have a, let me put it this way, you don't have an end of the contract to fulfill.
Right.
By being born,
you're
the
entitled
government
to everything.
Will fulfill its
yep.
end.
You're entitled to healthcare, a house, internet. What other things are human rights now? Food, water, shelter, internet, healthcare, sex change operations, right? That's a human right now. Yeah, all those things are just, you're just, there's no burden on you. And we know that's not right, right? You're already using the wrong thing when you say that, because, you know, if neither party gets a value out of it, then no value was really exchanged. It's not a contract, right?
Right, and that's why the contract theory was used, right? That's why John Locke came up with that metaphor of the contract, because you are trading something in order to get something in return. You're not just existing, and then society has given you things. And that's why when it's on the macro level, it's happening on the micro level, right? It's a feedback loop, right? We're talking about how the micro level leads to the macro, but then the macro reinforces the micro level. Where if you give people all these entitlements, or people don't have to understand their contract in society, and this is a big point with objectivism that a lot of people miss, right? They say, well, if you're being selfish, you're not going to care about other people. You're not going to have a basic benevolence. You're not going to be wanting to be nice to people. No, you want your values to exist, and you want to have as nice of a society as possible, so you're going to be that way to other people. I've always said this. If I want people to be nice to me in public, I'm going to be nice to other people in public, and I think people don't have that anymore. They don't have that. They don't care about that anymore. They just want to go out. Other people are just obstacles in their way, and I felt that very much in California. I didn't feel it as much here, but I think it became even, we talked about this during the pandemic. I think this became even worse in the pandemic, where we're basically saying other people are a threat to us. There's no social contract anymore.
Right. Yeah. If every person is a potential, if we treat every person as a potential incubator for a killer virus, then the benevolence goes out the window, right?
Yeah.
And every conversation is taken in with that interpersonal hostility, right? As a sort of game theoretical race to the bottom, right? If you're the asshole first, maybe you can intimidate them into doing what you want, rather than like, oh, hey, I noticed this, right?
Right. And you're in California, so you're not out in public as much as I am, but I don't see conversations between strangers anymore. I don't participate in conversations with strangers anymore. Every conversation I have nowadays is more business-like than anything. It's people I have to talk to, you know, kids in class, other teachers, administrators, other coaches, right? I don't have those. I mean, I had a nice conversation the other day in the apartment complex gym with a guy who had the Batman Under Armour shirt on from BVS, from Batman versus Superman. But beyond that, like when I go to the gym, I don't talk to random people. But I don't think there is that public space anymore. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it just doesn't in California for sure. And maybe not in Florida where you are, but like, I would hate to, and maybe some of our listeners can talk about in their sort of like regions, because, you know, that's like a staple of the Midwest. Like, I think I've told the story before on the podcast, but one of the hardest things when I moved from the Midwest, from Michigan to Baltimore, is kind of summarized in this overtold joke by me, which is, you know, you're in the line at Meijer in Michigan and you talk to the person behind you in the grocery line. But in Baltimore, you stab the person behind you in the grocery line. And that, you know, to explain the joke for a second, that the reason that everyone from Baltimore laughs is because no one talks to each other at the store. Like, that you're a weirdo, homeless, mentally challenged person, right? Like that's the only crazy people, or you're a scammer. That's it. No one else talks to each other in the grocery store. But that is totally the opposite in the Midwest, right?
Right. No, 100%. Isn't that more more effort though to stab the person behind you rather than in front of you?
Like, you actually, well, the person in front of you may have already paid. So, person behind you probably has more money.
Okay. I was wondering about that. I was like, because if you stab the person in front of you, you can stab them in the back and they won't see it coming. Well, and I used earlier the word narrative very intentionally, William, because I think that this is the narrative we've been told as a culture since we were kids, especially. And I think we've unpacked that narrative a lot in on the show in the Midside. And interestingly, you know, people know about this who I've talked to personally, my friends. There's a pro wrestler named EC3 who his whole thing right now is about the narrative. And he's saying what the narrative is that holds you down and holds you back. And then he's all about creating his own narrative. And he had this promo recently. It's about a minute on YouTube. And I heard this promo and I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And then I immediately bought the t-shirt for it, bought the tank top for it. And I just wanted to play it and just share my thoughts and then get your thoughts on it. Because I think it's really relevant. And I think there are a lot of people out there who are like this, or who have thoughts like this, or who are creating good content, and we're just not seeing them anymore because they're getting drowned out. And this is sort of my first step towards like, hey, I'm going to start sharing this stuff on the show. So go ahead and play that drop.
The narrative is built upon three essential pillars. Control. You have been controlled your whole life. Politicians, corporations, media, religion, even love, they have all had authority over you. There is no authority here. You dictate the terms. You decide if you win or lose. You decide the person you want to be. Freedom. In the narrative, you have freedom. The freedom to act. The freedom to think. The freedom to feel. You have the freedom to speak. Purpose. Within the narrative, you achieve mental acuity, physical prowess, and spiritual awakening. In the narrative, you achieve self-realization. Through self-realization, you find purpose. The narrative. Control. Freedom. Purpose. They have been warned.
So in this, William, he was sort of saying his own alternative narrative to the broader cultural narrative that exists. And what struck me about it is, you know, he talks about control, freedom, and purpose, right? And I hear those three things, and I hear the way he describes them, especially the way he defines them, and it really makes me think of the John Galt speech from Atlas Shrugged, where Galt talks about reason, purpose, and self-esteem. So the order that would be done here to make it the same as EC3's is reason, self-esteem, and purpose.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy to me that I don't think he's read Atlas Shrugged. I think he's just sort of coming to this on his own, inducing this on his own. And it's just crazy to me that like a pro wrestler is saying this. So I don't know what that says about our society or anything, but
is quote unquote low culture going to save us from the Church of Social Justice? Maybe.
Well, that's always been part of what the Midside is, right? Blending the low and high and saying, you know, there's nothing wrong with the low and there's value exactly. in the low,
yeah.
right? I mean, if you look at EC3 in this video, like look at him, right? The guy, I mean, I don't know if he's taking supplements or not. I personally don't believe in taking supplements when working out, but some people do. The guy's ripped out of his mind, right? And he reads. Who knows if he's read Atlas Shrugged, but clearly he reads and clearly he understands discipline and hard work and he's very well spoken. He's an intelligent guy. So I think that's something we need to grapple with here, the low versus high and where that's going with. I mean, do you see how I'm making that comparison to reason, self-esteem, and purpose to what he's saying with control, freedom, and purpose? Like his definitions are similar, right?
Yeah, they are. I think it is, you know, it's sort of like not the terminology, like you said, that I would use necessarily, but, you know, I would want to see more of what he's going to do with the character and how this will kind of play out because it, like you said, it's a induction that's pretty close, right? It's quite, and it's quite powerful in the form that he's described it. So let's see if it takes hold. I mean, that would be pretty exciting.
Yeah. And so to give you a little more background for it, William, he was in WWE and they cut him after not using him at all. And now he was in Impact Wrestling. Now he's in Ring of Honor and he's saying, I'm going to go where I want and I'm going to tell my own story and I'm going to tell my own narrative and I'm going to force all of you to rise and be better and be better wrestlers because I want the best competition and we're all going to be better because of it, and you're going to be better because of this, and this is about you becoming better. So it's interesting to me, this angle. It's like you said, like this is where we have to go now, but at the same time, it's awesome. Like, I'm down. I'll try. I don't know where to watch Ring of Honor, but I'm going to try and watch Ring of Honor. Right. I had to watch a promo on the YouTube channel where he almost made a 300 reference. He said he didn't mean to, but he was like, "Honor, I'll put the name to the test." And I was like, "What?" So now he's inducing Ayn Rand and Zack Snyder. Like,
oh man,
it's crazy to me.
Jeez, you're going to be start his fan club soon.
He lives not far from me in Orlando, and I keep buying t-shirts from him, so I'm sure he knows who I am. He likes, like, I tweet about him. I'll be like, often I'll retweet one of his tweets and I'll be like, "Oh man, this is another promo that, you know, applies well beyond wrestling," and he'll like it. So I don't know if he knows who I am yet, but we'll see what happens. Maybe we can have him on the show one day, but he's a pretty big person. Yeah. All right. Do you want to talk about, I don't want to say actual art, 'cause that's an insult to professional wrestling, but you want to talk about some art?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. And the Hope for Romantic with JML. To syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events in the air timeline lapse. My made for TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. If you would like to continue this conversation or have any other conversation with us during the week, you should join our Discord channel. We had some great conversation in it this week, a lot of new voices in there. It's always great to see all the new Midsiders who've joined the show, join the audience of the show. It's always great. You can do so by going to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, clicking on any episode link, and clicking on the Join Discord link. We'll talk to you in there. I made it back to the movies again. And William, I have to say that I'm going to be seeing a bunch of movies coming up here, right? In a couple weeks, I'm going to be seeing Freaky. Yes, that is similar to Freaky Friday. Freaky, it stars Vince Vaughn, and he's a serial killer, but he body swaps with like a blonde college-age girl. And it's by the same director of Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You. So this is another horror comedy. I'm really excited about Freaky. I'm going to see that on Friday the 13th. I'm going to have to find something to see next weekend, but, you know, I'll figure it out, something to see next weekend. But this weekend I saw Honest Thief. Honest Thief is a Liam Neeson movie. In it, he is a bank robber who was able to steal from about 8 or 9 banks without being caught. And he falls in love with a woman and then tries to turn himself in. But when he tries to turn himself in, the two FBI agents who he shows where some of the money is try to steal the money, and then shenanigans ensue where Liam Neeson has to go take in on them. And I say that very, very intentionally because, William, did you ever watch Steven Seagal movies growing up?
Yeah, of course. They were on the TV, man. On syndicated TV, that's the only entertainment I would have on hot summer nights.
And Steven Seagal movies were kind of like, okay, we know what Steven Seagal can do. He has a very specific skill set, and I'm using this language very intentionally because that's a Taken reference. And all we're going to do is come up with more and more ridiculous premises to put him in to be the same style of character doing the same style of thing. Liam Neeson has taken the role in society of Steven Seagal, right? This is the same thing where it's like, he's a former Marine. He came back. When he came back, an Enron thing happened that causes his dad to lose his pension. His dad committed suicide. So he robbed the bank and he got such a thrill from it that he started robbing a bunch of other banks of similar people who did moral wrongs, but he never spent the money. So he just had the money in storage units and that was it. He never took it. He never used it. He just enjoyed the thrill of being able to get away with stealing the money because he was a demolitions expert in the Marines. So you see how this is a very like, oh, let's figure out a way to make him the most moral bank robber ever. It's a very Steven Seagal premise in that way. And then he just goes about doing what he did in Taken. He tells the bad guys that he's going to hunt them down And then he hunts them down, and you know what's going to happen, that eventually in the end, he's going to come out on top. And look, if you like that kind of movie, you should see it. I'd say this is like a C movie. It's like a strong C plus. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed it. But it is what it is. You're not going to get some great work of art. You're not going to get some amazing movie that you're going to want to see over and over again. You're going to be like, oh, that was an enjoyable 2 hours of my life that I spent. And the thing you might enjoy the most, William, I have a question for you, William.
All right.
Ready? Have you ever seen a person who makes talking on the cell phone seem as important and epic as Liam Neeson does?
Yeah, he definitely makes it seem like he's right there next to you, right? He's intimidating you through the receiver.
The way he holds the phone, the way he pushes the button, the way he talks, this guy has figured out, like, this is one of the biggest challenges actors have going forward, right? Because technology is going to be a big part of movie scenes from now on, especially, you know, with the pandemic where nothing's face-to-face. I mean, I think they had that whole show on NBC called Disconnected or something, where everything takes place via Zoom or whatever. And I watched that horror movie Unfriended this week where the whole thing takes place on Zoom. There was that John Cho movie Searching, which it all took place via the computer. So actors are going to have to answer this challenge, but maybe they can just take the Liam Neeson masterclass, because this dude, like, I've never seen somebody make talking on the phone look so epic. I don't know how he does it. But it's just like, even when he pushes the button, you're like, yeah, push that button, Liam Neeson, push it. It's just like he's just pushing a button.
So it sounds like a fun action movie ride, just the kind of thing you want to sling some popcorn back.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's what you're going to get from Liam Neeson now. That's what you'll get from him for the rest of his career. And you know what? It's a good thing in society. I think we need more of it, right? We need more of, like, and I loved Steven Seagal movies growing up for this reason. It was like, oh, here's the good guy put in a ridiculous situation by bad people, and we want to see him come out on top. I think that's an important style of movie. I think that's an important style of movie. So I think it's worth seeing, especially, like you said, sling some popcorn back at AMC. I will keep saying this because it's awesome. I pay $5. I get a popcorn. I snack on it. I don't have to wear a mask the whole movie. Perfect. Perfect.
Man, I'm so jealous. I might fly out to Orlando just to do that.
Hey, anyone's welcome. You want to go see a movie with me one weekend? Come fly out to Orlando. We'll go see a movie.
Well, it would be great, but they keep pushing back Bond. So I was literally looking forward to that.
Well, that's why I hadn't been to the movies in a while, because I thought they were just pushing everything back. And then I finally was like, you know what? I'm just going to look in the AMC app. And I saw all these movies and I was like, wow, they're really not putting any money into movie marketing right now. It's almost like they want to kill the theaters. It's almost like these studios want to kill the theaters.
I think so.
Let's talk about, though, some things that are actually coming out. We'll do the marketing for you. We'll do the marketing for you when we talk about some trailers. Trailer Takedown is finally back. As always, if you want to, you know, watch the trailers beforehand, we post them on usually the Saturday before the episode comes out. You know, you can watch them before the episode, you can watch them after the episode, or you can during. You know, you can watch a trailer, pause, and listen to the episode, then pause the episode, watch a trailer, so on and so forth.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The Expanse, Season 5. Right, William? Season 5?
Absolutely.
Look, I don't have a lot to say about this trailer, William. I'm sure you're going to have a lot to say about it. I watch this trailer and I go, wow, I really like The Expanse. So this makes it seem like, I will say this, this makes it seem like it's consistent in quality. I know what I'm getting, and it makes me look forward to it. And it doesn't really spoil anything. That's the thing I most appreciate, right? I think it called back that guy who became the new leader of the Belters, right? That was a big plot in season 4, and how he's going to cause some mischief and stuff. But that's expected from the season 4 plot, that's dangling, that's going to come into season 5. So I appreciate that there wasn't a lot of spoilers in this. And I will say this, I'm going to say something controversial that you may not like, but I think this trailer is what season 4 should have been. This is more consistent with the broader world building that I like of The Expanse. I like of The Expanse that the main guy, I don't remember his name, but he's on the fringe, right? He's on the fringe of the universe as it expands, as our understanding expands, and his micro events affect all of humanity. And I like seeing that rather than like, oh, we're on a planet. And they tried to do that on a planet, but I don't think it worked as well. It turned into more of a Stargate SG-1 in season 4. So I think season 5, this trailer looks like what season 4 should have been, or at least what I would have liked from season 4. So this is a big hug for me.
Hug.
You sure this isn't personal?
You're damn right it's personal.
You know I had to reuse that drop. Yeah, super excited about season 5. I think you have a great point there, Justin. The trailer doesn't give anything away. Speculation. I haven't read the book, so I'm on the edge of my seat. And even people who have read the books have said that they've kind of mixed things up in a good way in the adaptation, rearranging some events and rearranging some of the narrative outline, not necessarily the events too, but just the narrative outline and making sure you arrive at the same beats and themes. It does feel like this is going to be larger. I was going to ask you too, Justin, does it feel like maybe the budget has been upped a little? Like it seems like, not that they skimped necessarily on season 4, but transitioning to Amazon and stuff like that, it seemed like they did a really good job. They've always done a great job on the effects. But if this trailer is any indication, it seems like there's a lot. It seems like a lot more. It seems like bigger in some ways.
Well, that was what I asked you, I think, when it transitioned. And when I got to that transition, when I binged it during lockdown, I said what it switched to Amazon in season 4 is the reason they did such a smaller scale story because of the budget. So I don't know. That'd be an interesting thing to ask producers, the ask the showrunner.
We'll have to see how it plays out. As far as what it's teasing, it's definitely I think the reservedness is great in making sure that we don't really know what's going to happen, right? Because of the cliffhanger, and we don't really know the consequences. The things I hope we do continue exploring that fringe. We have the whole mystery of what happened to the builders of the ring and what is the race that took the ring folks out. We still have that.
Well, that's what I mean about season 4. Like season 4 didn't address any of that. I felt like it was just like ignored.
Yeah. Yeah. And Miller's gone now, so that's kind of done. But then we have this revenge plot not necessarily a revenge plot, but I'm smelling a revenge plot with Amos and going back to Baltimore and dealing with the consequences of Earth. And it's going to be cool. I don't know how the Alex and what's her name? Sort of story is going to resolve either. So there's a lot of cool things to explore here and, continue to see the themes unfold. It's just super exciting. And I'm going to be watching it and I'll probably be live tweeting it when I do. I'll post that on Discord when it comes out. Good sci-fi, I've said this before, is so hard to come by. And this really does something that I don't think any other sci-fi show on television is doing right now. So, do I even really have to say it?
Hug.
Yeah, let
Second
me know what it comes.
Trailer.
Way to step on it, Justin.
Way to step on it, Justin.
There we go. Let me know when it comes out, and I'll watch it, and we'll make sure we can do. Are they going to do it by week?
I have no idea. So I hope they do. I don't know if it's going to drop the entire season or do it by week. I think there's a huge advantage of doing it by week. So I hope they do.
Well, let's say this. Even if they don't release it by week, we will watch it by week and discuss it by week on the show.
Yeah. I think that'd be great.
So let me know. Now hit it.
Second trailer.
Come Away stars Angelina Jolie and a bunch of black people. And I say that, look, I say that facetiously because I'm going to be honest with you. I have no idea what this movie's about, right? So Angelina Jolie is in love with this black guy. I don't know if they're officially like married or anything. That's not clear. But the black guy, I think, has two kids. And the two kids, here's where things start to really break down and not make sense. Because before, it's just like, hey, here's a generic setup of an interracial relationship. Okay, fine. Here are the two kids. The daughter is Alice from Alice in Wonderland. And the son, her brother, is Peter Pan. What? Nothing else in the trailer explains why they're those two people, why they're related, what this has to do with anything. They seem to be hinting at there's a conflict of people making them not want to believe who they are or something. Like, don't believe you're these fairy tale characters. I really don't know. Maybe the point of this trailer is, and if you look at a lot of the comments, people seem to be that the point of this trailer is to make these traditionally white characters black. I have no idea. All I know is from a pure story-based standpoint, let's remove the race, right? Let's remove race completely. If you tell me, here's a story where Alice from Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan are brother and sister, and they're, you know, young kids, and you don't tell me why, and you don't tell me what the conflict is, I would say that is a stupid premise. It's like they took that show Once Upon a Time and they made it less interesting. Like, Once Upon a Time was just like pure fan wank, right? It was like, we're just going to find a way to throw all these Disney characters together at the same time. And they made it work on some sort of level because they took the Lost approach to it in the beginning, because it was two of the producers of Lost. And it worked for a little bit. And it just got more and more absurd, but they at least tried to like make it work. And there was like a whole battle over the magic world versus the real world and everything. This trailer has none of that. The aesthetic seems to be more naturalistic. I have no idea what this movie is, and I don't even care about the racial aspects of this. Just as a story, as a movie, this just seems terrible. Tackle.
Well, you know, I have to rant, identifying as a woman, you know, you want to pick the best actors to tell your story, right? And we see this all the time. There's all this like representation bullshit. And why I think it's bullshit is fairly easy. If a straight dude can play a gay dude better than a gay dude, I want the better actor, regardless of their identity, right? So if I would say this, if there is no story point for the race of these characters, and these were the best actors for these roles, then great. But we have no way of knowing that in today's climate of social justice and identity politics. We have no way of knowing what's being done here, right? And unfortunately, the trailer doesn't tell us, right? All we can do is draw conclusions based on what Hollywood has been spitting out lately. And this just looks like you said, it seems like a subversive sort of, we're going to use these characters that you like, and I don't know. I just smell and we're going to tear them down, right? I don't see how it could be any other way, which would certainly explain why they're not going to tell you the conflict, right? Because then it would be super obvious. We're just going to tear down these characters you love. I don't know. Is that too fatalistic on my part, Justin? Either way, this is a tackle.
I don't know if it's fatalistic on your part. I mean, you're certainly correct that they're trading on this is Angelina Jolie, this is Alice in Wonderland, and this is Peter Pan. So come see this movie. But at the same time, that's what I was saying about the aesthetic, William. Okay, Angelina Jolie is Angelina Jolie, right? You put her in a movie, you can't get away from her aesthetic, right?
Right.
You know, whether you prefer that type of woman, she's a beautiful woman, right? Some people like that kind of beauty. Other people don't, right? That's a personal preference. Mm-hmm. But she's easy on the eyes, whether that's something, you know, your preferred beauty or not, right?
And she can be quite talented as an actor.
Right. Well, I don't think she can be quite talented. I think she is quite talented, and she can turn in quite good performances is what I think you meant to say.
Yeah.
But then these other characters, right? Would you know they were Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan unless you were told?
No, there's nothing to really show it.
Correct, which is what makes it so terrible. It's telling, not showing. Now, that's the trailer. Does the movie do it? I don't know, but we're talking about the trailer, so.
Third trailer.
Songbird is produced by Michael Bay, and it's a dystopian future where it's like COVID-23, I think they say in it. And in it, a guy is trying to get across the entire lockdown country to get back to his girlfriend. I think this is great, William. This is why I go to see movies, right? This is an action movie. And what it does is it takes something in reality and it exaggerates it. It takes it to the extreme to play with it and say, what would happen if this was exaggerated? What does it look like to an exaggerated degree? And that's what storytelling is to me. You take these premises and you put them in an action sci-fi type movie, and it reveals some truth about reality. And to me, you look at this and it's revealing, just even in this trailer, it's revealing the way this is all separating us. And it's revealing how the power exercised over us is separating us. And I think it looks tremendous. I think it looks tremendous. You know, could it turn out to be terrible if the social commentary is bad? Yes. But I don't see with the way this was done that the social commentary could be bad. The world they're setting up is implicitly saying that this type of authoritarianism is bad. So I think this would be tremendous. And to bring up the racial point, this is what you were just saying. The leads in this movie are Hispanic. And you know what? It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. You watch it, and it's just the human story here is, hey, this guy's trying to get back to his girl, and you want that to happen, and the world, it's just disgusting that it's keeping them apart, and it's just terrifying the way everyone's acting in this world. So for me, this is something I look forward to a lot. I can't wait for this movie to come out. This is a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, I made the mistake of looking through the YouTube comments and tons of conspiracy theories around this movie. I think this is one that I'm interested in seeing. The premise is, like you said, interesting. It looks like the production quality is good. The isolation elements are good. The thing is, I don't know when I'll be ready to see a movie like this. And what I mean by that is, especially in California, Justin, I'm living in this world right now, right? And so for me, it could be a challenge. I would need your sort of endorsement post watching it in order to make sure I could watch this. Because if the commentary goes sideways, if it, you know, sort of does the authority as good or, you know, the science as a cult, right, sort of thing, I don't know that I'd be able to watch it, right? It's just it becomes too close to reality in that case, right? I think some commenter put it this way: it would be like, you know, making a movie about the aftermath of September 11th between when the planes hit and the towers fell, right? And while I see that as rhetorical flourish, the sentiment I understand, and for me that definitely does affect me. So I think this becomes a Netflix and hug for me.
Netflix and hug.
And I've heard people say that, certainly. That they need the distance and they don't know if this is going to bring people back to theaters. But the point of making a movie is not to bring people back to theaters. That's a different thing on its own.
Mm-hmm.
The point of a movie is to make art that reflects our society and comments on it.
Right. Well, great.
I don't want to say the word society. Our life.
Yeah.
Our lives.
And that's why I sort of described it in the way I did, because, you know, I had a conversation, I had a Tinder swipe conversation that ended after I said this. A guy who was a artist working in the film industry, does sculpture on his own, of course, very abstract stuff, not necessarily my style. And, you know, I think I said something about one of them that I liked. And he said something about, well, art is subjective anyways. And of course, you know, I couldn't help myself. And I was like, oh, well, it's subjective to me. You know, it's spiritual fuel. So like the ones that I like are the ones that, you know, that I want to interact with, the ones that give me spiritual fuel. And so for me, I would say the same thing about this movie, right? Like, I don't know if at this time it would give me any spiritual fuel. So objectively, I have to say not worth my time, right? And,
yeah,
and
no,
so
I get
until
it.
And someone I think can that's... filter it for me, there's no reason for me to invest the 2 hours or whatever it's going to be.
Right. And I think that filter is a lot of what the value of the midside brings to people is. I think my track record's pretty good at nailing these things. I think you've nailed some things as well, but I think my track record in particular is pretty good at nailing these things. And I'm telling you from this trailer, I mean, especially with the whole plot of like her neighbor gets it and then like they're trying to like force her to comply and everything. Right. I don't see how that can be pro authority.
Yeah.
Unless at the end of the movie, like they get together and they like both immediately die because she infects him or something. And it turns into some weird Romeo and Juliet thing. Right. But that would just be, that would be, again, unless this trailer is hiding a lot, that would be a terrible ending. That would be a terrible execution of what they were going for. Yeah. If you get what I'm saying.
Yep. Makes a lot of sense.
So I will gladly take that risk.
Final trailer.
William, I want you to go first on this one. This is the Peacock. Peacock, the NBC streaming service, has finally released the full trailer for the Saved by the Bell sequel. I guess we'll call it. It's sort of like Cobra Kai, except for Saved by the Bell.
I wish it were Cobra Kai, except for Saved by the Bell.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Do you have nostalgia for Saved by the Bell? Do you even remember any of the characters? I sure hope you do.
Are you kidding me?
Because, hey, this is my pitch for the, this is my review. Okay. I sure hope you do, because we're going to jump right into it and just have nothing but nostalgic references and ridiculous situations and some self-awareness and some humor.
You were asking me.
As someone who did not particularly get into Saved by the Bell, this didn't hook me in any way. And what I mean by that is I couldn't tear it out of the let's remake everything and bring social justice to it sort of thing. Now, I'm going to say my social justice meter did not move very much during, if at all, during this trailer. So I'm not particularly worried about the social justice thing. Well, mine
completely
did.
Wrong.
Yeah. I saw some discussion of privilege, but it seemed like a joke and it really would depend on where the show's going with it. But I don't know. I have such a high bar for comedy, and I know this is something unique to me. So I didn't see anything wrong. I didn't see anything that would make me want to watch this. There are other better shows to watch on television, so I'm going to tackle.
William, what you said about it's not going to really bring in any new viewers, it's what makes this very insidious. The entire purpose of this show is to undermine the original show. And more fundamentally than that, this is part of the ongoing narrative of undermining our culture and trying to basically use their term of quote-unquote, forgetting the word, where they try to convince you
what subverting you're seeing, expectations? Gaslighting.
No. Gaslighting, thank you. I was thinking of lamps, and I couldn't think of the type of lamp. But yeah, of the continued gaslighting, quote-unquote, to use their terminology, that the way we grew up in our lives weren't really good, and they were actually evil, and that American culture is actually this evil, insidious thing, and that everything that came before it is a fiction. And that's not what the show is, and that's not what the show was, and they're trying to do that. And I'm going to prove that. So what I did was I pulled 15 seconds out of the show, out of the trailer. It's the privilege part that you're talking about. And there's more around it, though, that really shows what's going on.
We all want these new kids to feel welcome.
Can we talk?
Did you just sit backwards in a chair? Wow, I've never seen anyone do that in real life.
It's not going to work unless we get to know them.
You only know how Bayside works for kids like you.
Hot kids. Privileged kids.
Privileged kids.
So in this segment, Elizabeth Berkley and Mario Lopez, Jesse Spano and AC Slater are talking about how they're going to introduce the new kids, right? They're going to get to know them. This is obviously a meta reference because the new kids are the kids who are joining the show. They're the next generation, right? Then they show AC Slater talking to a young black man in the Max, which was one of the hangout places, and he does what he normally does, which is sit around backwards in a show, or turn the chair around backwards and sit down. And the show makes a joke out of this. And now this is supposed to be a, haha, here's a clever joke about what the show did. But what it's really trying to do is present the show as unrealistic. because it makes it seem like it hurt him to sit backwards in a chair. And it also makes it seem like nobody sits backwards in a chair. First of all, I've sat backwards in chairs before. I've seen other people sit backwards in chairs before, and it doesn't hurt to sit backwards in a chair. William, can you give any commentary on that?
I can confirm. Unless you have one of those office chairs with the arms, especially in places like McDonald's and other fast food restaurants, it's pretty common to see people sitting backwards in the chair.
And have you sat backwards and it doesn't hurt?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So that entire joke there, the only purpose of that joke is if you're accepting the premise that things the original show did were completely unrealistic. The original show was based upon the idea of taking the common high school life and exaggerating it by distilling it and making it happen in 22 minutes. So it's saying, oh, here's the one where you have to ask the girl to the school dance. Oh, that's going to happen in 22 minutes. Oh, here's the one where you have driver's ed. Well, that's going to happen in 22 minutes. Oh, here's the one where the guy, Johnny Dakota, comes in and tries to sell you weed. That's going to happen in 22 minutes. Right? It distilled it down. That's what it was about. Right? Yeah, and it was hokey and it was cheesy and it was over the top. That was the point. It was pulp romanticism. Pulp romanticism, right? It's not a great work of art. It's pulp romanticism. Well, this is taking that show and it's undermining it by saying it wasn't realistic. And then the second thing is the privilege thing. The girl who says that is Hispanic, and she's saying that to Zach Morris's kid and another white girl who's a ditzy white girl. And it's implying that the original show was based around rich white kids. Now, the original show, okay, did it take place in Malibu? Yes. Was that ever an issue? No. Do we know in reality that Malibu is a place for rich kids? Yes. But money was never made an issue. Now, perhaps the argument would be that, oh, well, the lifestyle these kids had isn't the normal lifestyle for everyone. Is it for everyone, or was this show for people growing up, kids growing up in the suburbs, kids growing up on Nickelodeon, kids growing up on Saturday morning cartoons who had a comfortable lifestyle? I'm not saying it's a privileged lifestyle. I'm not saying it's a rich lifestyle, but this is what normal life was for most of us. And the idea of America was to make it so everybody could have this lifestyle. But instead, we're supposed to believe that what they showed, that normal lifestyle, isn't normal. That we're supposed to feel guilty about it, that it's only a result of privilege. So they're doing something much more insidious here. And this is where the discussion of Cobra Kai can come in, right? They're doing something where we're saying the original show was evil and it deserves to be destroyed and undermined. Now, William, that's why I want to ask you about Cobra Kai. Because right. Karate Kid was part of the 80s push that Hollywood had to undermine the alpha and show how evil the alpha was in favor of the beta. But Cobra Kai flips that on its head. And it flipped that on its head and it says, well, now we've lost masculinity. And the guy you thought was the good guy, Daniel LaRusso, the Karate Kid, the beta, is actually pretty messed up. And look how it's destroyed the life of Johnny Lawrence, the alpha. Is that just doing the same thing and we're only okay with it because it's in line with reality? And then isn't the argument at that point, well, yeah, that is why we're okay with it, but that's what makes it good and the other one evil, is the disconnect from reality and the connection to reality.
False dichotomy, bro. I think that the way that they treat Danny is way more subtle and complex, right? They're not Agreed. Saying that... I don't know that the distinction is exactly that dichotomy of alpha and beta, right? This was, if anything, this was toxic masculinity in the true sense of the word, right? It was like masculinity, destructive masculinity is probably the better way to describe it, right? The
Karate Right, and to back up what you're saying, they really had that distinction at the end of season one where they brought back the original Cobra Kai sensei and showed how he was toxic masculinity where Johnny Lawrence isn't.
Yeah, and I really prefer the term destructive masculinity in this case because unfortunately there's so much baggage with toxic masculinity. It's the term has sort of been overloaded. So destructive masculinity, right? And what we saw also though was there was this evasion that was happening with the softer sort of masculinity, right? There's this evasion happening and this like refusal to sort of identify like to hide behind the sort of othering of this of this actual legitimate force, right, of masculinity. It's like pushing it out and saying that this is bad completely, right? And the way that's handled in the show is very complex and subtle, and I think that's the difference here, right? I don't know, based on the you know, I think I'm agreeing with you. You're bringing me around to your side here on the trailer, because there's no indication that this will be handled subtly, right? We still may disagree with it, right? But if it's just going to completely shit on the show, right? And at no point does Cobra Kai shit on the Karate Kid, right? Like everyone is, all the characters have complex relationships with those events from the Karate Kid movies, but there's immense respect for Mr. Miyagi. There's immense respect for sort of the art and the masculinity of it, right? Whether it's the soft form or the destructive form, right? There's still respect for masculinity overall.
So, right, and Cobra Kai then comes off more as commentary on what was going on culturally at the time than it does the original movie. So right. It's saying, hey, here's how at the time, culturally, we were telling these stories about how the Daniel LaRusso character was superior to the Johnny Lawrence character, and we needed to celebrate them, but look what it's done to the Johnny Lawrence character. And Johnny Lawrence almost represents Los Angeles in that way, and almost represents American society. I mean, it's filmed in Georgia, but the place where the Cobra Kai Dojo is, it looks like a strip mall in California that's run down. It's
yeah,
one of the
looks like
things
a
I hated.
Place in Reseda, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like that. That's one of the things I hated living there, was just the aesthetic of that. It's like there's been no upkeep on it for 15 to 20 years because of the cost of living. And I think Cobra Kai comes across that way. And what you're saying is Cobra Kai manages to take a movie that wasn't that subtle, but had some subtlety to it, and added more subtlety to it. Whereas the Saved by the Bell sequel somehow takes a show that wasn't subtle at all and makes it even less subtle.
Crazy. So
I thought you'd have more response.
Well, no, I was waiting to hit the tackle button. I think you're going to tackle it.
Oh, clearly I'm going to tackle it. But I wanted to go ahead and say tackle.
Tackle.
But I really wanted to go this deep on it because this is intentional, yeah. Right? This is intentional. Whereas I think the Cobra Kai people want to just tell a good story, and the more interesting story is not, hey, Daniel LaRusso has multiple car dealerships and he has a wife and a couple kids, right? That's not a very interesting story. The interesting story is Johnny Lawrence, and look at how run down his life is, and look at how it's an effect of what happened. And in a way, I'm going to make a crazy connection here. Isn't that what Donald Trump ran on? Make America Great Again? Isn't he appealing to the Johnny Lawrence types? And yeah. I don't think they're intentionally, you know, trying to fit the Trump thing in. But I think they see that that's the more interesting story that's going on right now. Where is our masculinity? How is it an effect of the 80s and the 90s? Right? How is it the effect of how the kids in the 80s and 90s like us were raised? And how is that affecting the kids now? That's why Cobra Kai is a good story. Whereas Saved by the Bell is just like, oh, everyone back then is stupid. And now the kids nowadays are smart and they have to fight back against everyone that was stupid. And there's no subtlety there or anything. And so I think that the intent of Cobra Kai is to tell a good story, where I think the intent of the Saved by the Bell sequel is insidious. I think it's to undermine it. I think it's to destroy it. I think that's very much the intent. I don't think they're trying to tell a good story. Either that, to be more benevolent, it's either that or the people who make the show don't know the difference anymore because of how they've been brainwashed.
Yeah, could be.
All right, well, that sums up this episode. Let's put a bow on it. What did we learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned I need to add the band You, Me, and Everyone We Know to my Do Not Listen playlist. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
Oh, you faked me out there. I was like, no, don't do that. If we're talking about music, I learned, and I'll talk about it next episode if someone reminds me, but I learned that Machine Gun Kelly's pop punk album came out in September and nobody told me. So I'm going to listen to that and I'll talk about it next episode.
Yeah. Watch the videos on YouTube too.
Oh, I have been watching the videos. I've seen the videos. I've seen the Bloody Valentine video. I've seen Concert for Aliens. And the songs on YouTube are excellent, so I want to hear the full album.
Yeah.
Oh, plug. I have to plug. That's up to me. That's up to me to plug. So let me open the document here. As always, thank you for listening. Really appreciate it. This show would not be anything without you. I would just be me talking into a microphone and William correcting me a lot of the times. So thank you. Thanks to the Liberty.me listeners. As you can see, we're going a much different direction. I hope you still stick around. Even though we're less political, we're still pro-freedom, pro-individualism. If you want to get a t-shirt or any sort of merch, you can look at themidside.com/store. Likewise, my book is coming out, The Cut. If you go to themidside.com/the cut, that comes out on November 17th. If you want to read my novel, if you want to support us on Patreon or Locals, Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/Locals. And as always, the most important way, the best way you can help the show is to tell a friend. This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Elmozeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have an awesome post-Halloween. So Justin, I did have about 8 families show up trick-or-treating, all quite polite, and I passed out a ton of candy. But unfortunately, I have a ton of candy left, like a lot of candy left.
What are you going to do with it?
I don't know, because I don't really eat it. So maybe pass it out during, you know, the afternoons when everyone's out walking the dog, and maybe maybe try to pass it out. I don't know. I don't want to be the creepy guy passing out candy, though.
I don't know, man. In every apartment complex I've never ever lived in, I've never had a trick-or-treater. And then this morning of recording this show, I went to Walmart to get the 50% off Halloween candy. So I have a different approach than you.